stop the world.
The only way that Australia is going to have enough systems with the reach and persistence to be able to have a real presence in our region and provide deterrent effects is through autonomy.
Welcome back to Stop the World, ASPE's weekly podcast on international affairs and security. I'm David Rowe. We have another double episode for you this week, this time on defence innovation and a new ASPE report exploring AUKUS Pillar 2. First up, ASPE's Director of Defence Strategy and National Security, Beck Shrimpton, is joined by Pete Quinn and David Goodrich from Anduril, as well as ASPE visiting Senior Fellow Kieran Joyce to explore the Australian defence tech space. They discuss the importance of autonomous systems, what role they can play in the Australian Defence Force, and how they can be used to help deter aggression in the region. Beck also asks David what role Australia can play in contributing to allied production of these capabilities.
Australia sits in a part of the world that is going to become more and more important from a geopolitical perspective. In the next decade, over 50% of the world's submarines will be located in the waters in and around the Indo-Pacific. So we need to play a part.
And later in the episode, ASPE's Steph Tiller speaks to George Henneke, a defence economist and senior ASPE fellow, about his new report looking at both the opportunities and challenges facing the Australian defence industry under AUKUS Pillar 2. They discuss the report's findings and explore the key reforms that Australia should focus on to ensure Pillar 2 is a success.
It's about more than the regulations. It's about the organisations that implement them and the sort of their risk assessments. In the past, those organizations have been far too risk averse. And even when exemptions exist, it's hard for people to take advantage of them because people are too afraid of making a mistake.
But for now, let's get into the conversation with Beck, Pete, David, and Kieran.
Well, here we are on the ASPE podcast, and today joined by Peter Quinn and David Goodrich of Anduril Industries. I will get you both briefly just to introduce your positions, if you don't mind, because you've both got really important roles that you play for Anduril in Australia. I'm also joined by a member of my own team, Wing Commander Kieran Joyce, who is somewhat of a specialist in autonomous systems, which is what we're talking about today. But just as a quick intro, perhaps Peter, if we start with you, or do you prefer Pete? We've known each other for a
Pete's
while,
great.
So I nearly went to Pete. Excellent. Pete, why don't you tell us about your new role and how you feel about it?
Thanks, Beck. Look, it's great to join you here today. I started my new role as the Vice President of Strategy for Anduril Australia in the Asia Pacific in January. I transitioned out of Navy about 14 months ago. My last role was the head of Navy capability and have really enjoyed this transition into a really leading edge company that's really going to make a difference for defence.
Excellent. Thank you. David, you've been with Anduril a little longer.
I set up Anduril Australia 2.5 years ago, and I am the executive chairman and chief executive of Anduril Australia and Anduril Asia Pacific. We run the region out of Australia. And as I said, yeah, we kicked off about 2.5 years ago, and it's been an absolutely wild ride since then.
Excellent. Kieran, you bring a unique and a uniformed perspective to this. Tell us about your interest and your experience with our autonomous systems and autonomy.
I've had the pleasure of running a lot of the ADF's uncrewed aerial systems programs over the last couple of years. And in particular, I've had a heavy involvement within our innovation ecosystem, working with the Defence Innovation Hub and as ASCA has been set up. So I have a really tight interest in what Anduril's doing as, with their pedigree of uncrewed aerial systems and now into UUVs, and really excited about development happening in Australia with companies like Anduril, with companies like C2 Robotics down in Melbourne. It's a really exciting place to be working in at the moment.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. And I share all of your enthusiasm for what is it's not really a new technology, but it's an increasingly important technology that is being applied in really new and interesting ways as we think about military capability. We had a Defence Strategic Review, of course, last year that directed Defence to look at how it could achieve asymmetric advantage from technologies. And we've seen a real focus from the Department of Defence, including the Australian Strategic Capability Accelerator's first problem set being in and around autonomy. From your perspectives, gentlemen, can you talk about what about the strategic environment makes autonomy so important? What do autonomous systems offer? And as I think about the conversation in Australia, we talk about tight budgets, workforce issues, etc. What does autonomy offer that is unique for the ADF?
It's a great question, Beck, and it'd be lovely if we could be speaking about autonomy in a time of peace. But one of the points that jumped out at me from the special report on escalation risks in the Indo-Pacific by William Lebden, released by ASPE a couple of weeks ago, was a comment in one of the earliest pages, I think on about page 5, which said that the outbreak of war in the Indo-Pacific is a real possibility. And that's a comment that we hear a lot, and it's a comment that the Defence Strategic Review has kind of spoken to in quite some depth. So from an autonomy perspective, if that is the case, then Australia needs to react to that. And that's really what the DSR is all about. It's really what the IIP recut is all about, changing the force posture. And autonomy has to be a big part in that, Pete.
Mm, it is a big part, David. Our traditional platforms, you know, our ships, our aircraft, our land systems are incredibly important. And it's great to see that we are investing in those systems. But we've got such a huge area. We're surrounded by three enormous oceans. We've got a huge littoral area to our north. The only way that Australia is going to have enough systems with the reach and persistence to be able to have a real presence in our region and provide deterrent effects is through autonomy. We've got a huge area. We've got a fairly small population. And to go with autonomy and to go with these new investments and new systems, we need to make sure that all of those systems are properly integrated together.
Mm-hmm.
All of the data,
yep,
the communications, the intelligence, they need to be fused together. The only way we're going to be able to do that is by harnessing artificial intelligence across the force, not just in those autonomous systems, but in the systems that connect all of those entities together. And that's our challenge. How do we do that quickly? How do we do it at the speed of relevance?
I think that's all something we should absolutely be leaning into in the ADF in particular, but something that certainly concerns me, and I'll run back to your opening comments, Beck. You said that in the challenging circumstance of workforce and dollars, we need to be thinking of this. Well, some of those threat actors we're thinking about, they don't have those same challenges. They don't have some of the same ethical boundaries as Western nations have. And certainly one of the things that I find challenging under the DSR and where we head from the DSR is if we are adopting these kinds of massed autonomous vehicles as part of our approach, well, you can bet your bottom dollar that so are they. And I do wonder, after recently completing the surface fleet review, and agreeing that 6 Hunter-class frigates is good enough to find Chinese submarines, well, is it good enough to find 1,000 Chinese LUUVs? Because if we're good enough to field those kind of technologies, then so are they. And I think that that equals a serious challenge that we're perhaps not giving enough credibility to at the moment, that our UUVs need to have counter technologies on board because 6 Hunter frigates aren't going to break an enemy blockade of our ports with their 1,000 or 10,000 submarines.
Kieran, I think they're great points. And one of the things that I really noted in the service fleet review is that the Hunters are biased towards ASW, but so are the Tier 2 ships as well. They've also been told to prioritise undersea warfare. And that's a key reason for that is under the sea is still a very opaque environment. It's still an area where you can have a level of stealth and persistence, and whereas a great environment to employ, I think, asymmetric capabilities. But to your point, potential adversaries are also embracing autonomous systems and at scale. So one of the things the ADF needs to do is we need to embrace them just so we understand them. Until you have those capabilities in your force, you learn how they operate, you learn how to employ them, you learn how to counter them. You need to do that. It needs to be part of our DNA for doing that. And we need to be continuously investing in the capability, evolving the capability, so we actually have a transient advantage over potential adversaries.
Beck, so much to talk about, the wise gentleman to my left here. But you know, the thing that jumps out at me is that we all think that the Defence Strategic Review is a timely document, an important document, but we don't have a minute, to Kieran's point, a minute to waste in getting after it. And it has been a little frustrating that it's been some time since the DSR has been released. And to Kieran's point, the adversaries don't wait for a DSR to get after new capabilities and new technologies. And in fact, at Anduril, the reason why we were founded was that, you know, the founders of Anduril believe that we are already behind the game and wanted to do something about it to get us back up to the game and then ultimately ahead of the game. And that's where Anduril is focusing its efforts in Australia. Its XL AUV program, named by Navy as Ghost Shark, is a three-year program to deliver three prototypes. Really proud to say that we're well ahead of schedule and that we are testing at the moment, and we are very, very pleased with the way in which that testing is tracking. And just to be really clear, Anduril Australia is developing this capability for the Royal Australian Navy in partnership with the Royal Australian Navy and DSTG. But really importantly, since the creation of ASCA, ASCA is now running alongside us at an incredible pace. That's a pace that sees it kind of embracing and leading in some ways the defence enterprise. And under the leadership of Professor Emily Hilder, who's been a partner of ours from the very beginning, and with the continuous support of Professor Tanya Munro of DSTG, it is this partnership that is allowing Anduril to do what it does best, which is to go fast. And Pete mentioned evergreening, and it goes to Kieran's point around keeping up with the threat. You just can't rely on your laurels. You can't stop once you've developed and delivered the capability. You've got to continuously evolve it. And that's the evergreening engineering process that is embodied within everything Anduril Australia is doing.
I'd like to pick up on a point that you made, Pete, about speed to capability. And we are talking about, and Dave, as you've mentioned before as well, the DSR has really doubled down on this sense of urgency and the need to deliver capability, lots of capability and lots of different capability fast. We have talked about one particular capability in one particular domain, but I'd love to know, you know, what are you seeing around the world? What trends seem to indicate? How can we take what we're doing in Australia, in the undersea domain, including how we're working with Australian industry and building Australian industry capability itself, to get after this problem? But how do we lift and shift those lessons from perhaps the undersea domain to the land, to the air, to the space, to the cyber, to command and control? Can you talk a little bit about what's happening globally, trends in autonomy and autonomous systems capabilities, and what that might mean for Australia going forward?
I could talk about that under wet cement, Beck, because it is so interesting and there's so much happening. And I might just riff off Pete here if I could, but I'll kick it off. I guess what is happening in the global tech development space in the defence realm at the moment is that there's an awareness that the speeds with which decisions have been made in the past are completely out of date and redundant. Decisions need to be made at a much, much faster rate, and that's a rate that the human being cannot achieve. With the complexity and the diversity of information and the ubiquity of information that is available, human beings in the old way of doing things, of multiple siloed systems, you know, with very unsophisticated communications between those systems, is just out of date. It's redundant. So this means that we need to embrace technology. And what is that technology? Well, it's a technology that, as Pete mentioned, utilizes artificial intelligence, machine learning, edge computing, computer vision, and fusing massive amounts of data and making sense of that data using all of those technologies.
And I think the way that you incorporate those technologies. Certainly the areas that I'm seeing where it's being most successful is where you introduce a technology which is good enough to link legacy systems together, sensors, systems, data from space, whatever the source of information, you need to be agnostic. You need to have open architected systems that can really link up to all those legacy systems. And then you need to put it out in the field in the hands of operators, you know, soldiers, sailors, aviators, and they need to test. We need to learn lots from that testing. We need to feed that back into the next version. You just need to continue to do that. We have to iterate. Gone are the days of opening the FMS catalogue and saying, I want three of those. Still important for some things, but that's not going to solve the challenges that we've got with the rapidly changing technology in our region. It's not going to solve our data issues. We actually have to make choices. We need to take a software-first approach, and we need to really work to iterate all of those legacy systems together and work out how we get then going to enable those systems with artificial intelligence and just continue to test, develop, iterate forever.
And you can't throw everything out that you've bought in the past and start again. That's just not a rational way forward. So Pete's statement around integrating legacy systems with cutting edge capabilities is so important and has never been more important than today. So it's this concept of what is the type of organization that can not force a government or a Department of Defense down a particular corporate route, but is, as Pete mentioned, open to all comers, Australian industry, international partners, and use the best of breed to be able to fuse all of that together to give a common operating picture to the warfighter.
It's a really nice comprehensive way to grip up sort of the requirements. Kieran, from your experience and perhaps implementation of some particular systems for the ADF, what are you thinking about here as some specific challenges perhaps that we might go to autonomy for? Yeah.
Thank you, Beck. I think the gents are absolutely on target that our innovation ecosystem, the adoption and the belief in the potential of AI and fast-moving technology evolution is there. I have no doubt at all that supporting agencies like the DST Group and the services are good at acknowledging that, making decisions, and we've seen really good prototyping efforts over the last 7 or so years out of Warfare Innovation Navy, out of the RICO from Army, and out of Jericho from Air Force. But they don't buy the equipment. CASG does, our Capability Acquisition Sustainment Group. And I haven't seen anything published since the DSR. I've heard some speeches from the DEPSEC, from Chris Diebel, saying that speed to capability is important. But I haven't seen any reforms hit the street yet within our Capability Acquisition Sustainment Group of how to do acquisitions faster or how to adopt digital engineering, evergreening, spiral upgrades. So I think that's something we do need to dig into, because we might be very successful at delivering a prototype technology to a minimum viable capability within 3 years that Navy loves and wants to do it. But if at the end of that process we have to run a two-pass approval process through government against a major sea project, well, you can bet your bottom dollar that's going to add 3 to 5 years before we see anything. And that concerns me. I think we should all be looking to CASG to adopt some of those principles from the DSR and publish that and get that out to industry to say this is the new framework of how we're going to do things faster, because industry isn't seeing that yet.
It sounds like there's a lot of wisdom coming from your past career, Kieran, and you're absolutely right that if we are going to embrace those principles that are so beautifully articulated in the DSR, there has to be change. But I am actually very hopeful that CASG understand that. And there's a lot of work going on in CASG led by Chris Diebel and his team. But it's a big organisation, you know. I think we've also got to be a little, I can't believe I'm saying this, but a little bit patient with the organization to allow it to figure out how to transition. I absolutely believe they get it. They understand that it needs to transition. And programs like the Go Shark program kind of proved that there is a way to contract in a very efficient and effective manner. We had the good fortune of working with the DSTG team to contract for our $140 million co-investment. Just to remind your listeners that Anduril contributed $70 million of that $140 million. And the contracting process was done very collaboratively, very efficiently, and very effectively. And I don't think I'm speaking out of turn by saying there has been zero contractual issues associated with that program, and we're more than halfway through.
And I just to add a couple of points to David and to agree completely with you, Kieran, for a program like Go Shark, we've had to build the engineering expertise, and we built that in Australia, tens of engineers here, and we've also built a base of suppliers, small and medium enterprises. We've built them up. They're providing real Australian technology into the Go Shark. If at the end of the prototyping phase, then we go into a phase of thinking about things for, you know, 2-3 years, that will all disappear. You know, the sort of engineers that we have are people that love incredibly hard challenges. We've been giving that to them. If we can't continue to give them an incredibly hard challenge, we'll lose them.
So let me just double tap on that, because you know, Pete's, I think you're setting me up here, Pete, because you know that I'm passionate about this. Australia has the most incredible pool of engineering talent that you could dream of. And it's not tens of engineers. We've now built a team of over 90 people. And our engineers are diverse in every single possible way, from the industries, the companies. They come from the likes of Google, SpaceX, Atlassian, defense industry, academia, and government, and veterans like Pete himself. And it's that diversity and that eclectic mix of people who share the mission that we're getting after that I actually think is a national asset. And I think ASCA gets this, and the whole purpose of ASCA being created was to pull through programs from what used to be well-intentioned investment in innovation, you know, under a range of different funds, but didn't go anywhere. But now ASCA's got the mission to turn those innovations into programs and to pull them through with capability managers' support. And that's such an important tool and method to stop that circumstance that Pete was mentioning of, at the end of a prototyping program, a lot of navel gazing happening, which means time, and those really incredibly capable engineers who want to work on national security issues and defense issues, they will go elsewhere. Mm. And that would be a tragedy.
And a tragedy that we have seen happen before, right?
Time
so, you know, there really is an enormous imperative on all of the actors collectively together in the Australian ecosystem. This is industry, government, defence, together to make sure that we are creating a pipeline of capabilities that we can turn these brilliant minds to, right? But I guess the risk really is there that we can't or we don't, for whatever reason. And we've seen some delays on decisions, delays on programs while we waited for reviews and strategies. What role, perhaps, then, if we're looking for a constructive solution to this problem, might Australia be able to play in the broader region? And how can we work with partners? How can we actually use collaboration, cooperation, some of our deterrence goals, some of our capability development goals, to contribute to allied production, perhaps, and some of these other issues? Australia is a regional manufacturing and production hub. Talk to me about what we might be able to achieve there.
Brilliant question. And it's a question that we try to answer in the way in which we do things. At Anduril, we understand that we exist in a team of like-minded nations who believe that actually freedom is important, that democracy is a concept worth defending and fighting for. And that's why there are some of the most incredibly focused and loyal and capable individuals who work in defence, because they commit their professional and sometimes their lives, their actual lives, honouring that purpose. From a regional perspective, Australia sits in a part of the world that is going to become more and more important from a geopolitical perspective. I think there was a statistic that I heard when I was helping Admiral Samet negotiate the future submarine contract a few years ago, that in the next decade, over 50% of the world's submarines will be located in the waters in and around the Indo-Pacific. So we need to play a part. And the fantastic thing with our allies and our relationships is that we're seen to be a real partner. We punch above our weight. The ADF always has. We're relatively small, or very small compared to all of those large nations. What we can do is to continuously invest into the skills and capabilities of our incredibly talented workforce and pick some winners. We can't operate, I believe, in an environment where the amount of support and the amount of contracting activity is distributed, you know, completely evenly across every single participant, because none of those participants will scale. And for Go Shark in particular, we have some incredible industry partners that we are working with day and night to grow them, to give them confidence to invest into their businesses so they can grow to a scale that can not only serve the Go Shark program and Anduril's other programs, but all defense programs and defense innovations that are going on in this country. But that takes contracting certainty. And unless it's given to companies like Anduril, we can't pass it on.
A really key point that I don't think a lot of people realise is that we actually can make decisions very quickly in Australia. Mm-hmm. We're not legislatively bound to go through really long processes. We choose to sometimes because we do tend to revert to following process and adding process in and in some cases not taking the risk that we should. But where we choose to, we can make decisions very quickly. That is seen as being valuable by our close allies and partners.
100%.
But there are some areas where working with allies and partners is really important. Things like as we sort of scale the sort of things we're doing here in Australia, having the partners in, say, the US that can help us with the certification, which can help us with some of the testing and all that stuff is really valuable. So teaming that Australian innovation, the ability to move quickly in Australia, the incredible test ranges and things we have in Australia at Woomera, the underwater Woomera that I think we're developing off the east coast of Australia, to use those things and do it in partnership with our allies and to use some of their heft in certain areas, like we did with NOLCA, for example, a great Australian success story. But NOLCA took 20 years to develop. What can we do in two? What can we do in one?
And it can't be one-offs.
Partnership. Yeah. It can't be one-offs. Yeah. It has to be in our DNA. And a couple of key points to build on some things that David said before. The way you do things at speed is, number one, you don't spend 3 years writing a whole, you know, 50 pages of black letter requirements that defence isn't sure can be delivered and industry isn't sure to be delivered, and everyone agrees to deliver that, and then 10 years later you find out it's impossible to deliver. You need to agree on what's the threshold requirement, what are the problems we're trying to solve? What's the threshold to solve those problems and what's the objective? All agree to that and then move out quickly. And also don't expect to get perfect solutions. My mantra is if we can get 80% solution all the time, so 80% this year, but then 80% next year but against a harder problem, and then 80% the following year against a harder problem, that's how you get transient advantage and you move forward quickly. And you can do those things in partnership with your close partners and allies and those sort of things. Actually, diversity of thought, diversity of testing, all of those sort of things strengthens the capability.
And what we've seen with COVID is that supply chains are fragile.
Yeah.
So the more diverse your supply chain can be from a defence perspective in the, say, you know, the inevitable almost conflict that is going to happen here at some point, that's goodness for a allied approach to winning that conflict. If we are concentrating all of the manufacturing capability in one country, that's a risk, which I don't think we can afford to take.
I'd just love to chime in, and Anduril's new to the game here in Australia, but I'm really glad that Pete brought up NOLCA as an example. And, you know, if we're going to go back in history, Jindavik before that, you know, we have a real pedigree for uncrewed systems technology here in Australia. Some of those companies are already succeeding and have been succeeding for decades on the global export stage. you know, Advanced Navigation in Sydney, global exporter. APD and Currawong Electronic Speed Controllers, global exporters. Textron Systems, global exporter. Cube Pilot in Geelong is the West's largest manufacturer of flight controllers for UAVs in the world. Orbital Engines over in Western Australia, global exporter. That's what we need to tap. And they know how to do it fast. They work with commercial partners. They work with the US. They work with worldwide special operations communities. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. What we need to do is take advantage of what is already here. And Andrew's gone and got some of those amazing people and brought
and
in some of those
Advanced Nav are part of our team.
That's all sitting there on the shelf in Australia ready to tap right now. If we can make the decision-making happen, if we can make the acquisition cycles happen, we can absolutely capitalise on that.
We've got to scale those great companies. You know, too many of those great companies have not grown enough. And the problem is that we don't buy enough from them and we don't provide them with enough support for them to really grow to the scale that they deserve to be.
And that's a really important point. If we're to do manufacturing in Australia, it's not onesies and twosies. We need to have enough certainty so our mum and dad suppliers, innovative little suppliers, can take their mortgage deeds to their houses and go to the bank and say, hey, I need $20 million because I need to scale up, because I need to provide all these systems for, you know, this very important capability for defence. But they need certainty to do that. So certainty means we actually need to make decisions and we need to provide longer term certainty for the supply chain to grow and for us to grow, importantly, the talent, the people, resources.
All the policy's already there.
Yes.
So robotics, autonomous systems, AI was already on the sovereign industrial capability list on the last government.
Yep.
It's item number one in last week's released DIDS. From a policy perspective, it's all sitting there ready to be tapped.
So from a strategic direction perspective, I think we've been talking about it for a while. From a policy intent perspective, I think we've been talking about it for a while. And Pete, you'll remember 10 years ago we were talking about some of the capabilities emerging under US thinking under the third offset strategy. A lot of this is not new. A lot of these capabilities are sitting under our noses. We are rapidly running out of time, gentlemen. What I want you to do is give me a really quick answer to an on-the-spot question. Fast forward 20 years, we get these things right. What does the capability mix look like? What does our industry look like? And what are our investments? You know, how much bigger are they? I'm going to start with you, David, because I'm looking at you.
Great questions. I'm just loving this conversation with these people at this table. It's fantastic. In 20 years' time, I'd like to think we've got a really strong, capable, and thriving technology industry that serves both the defence market and the commercial market. I'd like to see us with career paths for the best and brightest women and men in Australia to choose to do STEM subjects at school and take them forward. I'd like to see an entrepreneurial environment that sees companies that are being created that don't just think of the Asia Pacific market as their place of business, but just the global stage and have confidence to do that. I'd like to think that in 20 years' time, the work that we're all doing as Australian industry providers for the Department of Defence has made it possible for us not to have had a global conflict and for peace to reign throughout the world. And that only comes from there being the very, very well understood capability of deterrence. And that deterrence comes from an ability to deploy mass effects at scale using software-driven artificial intelligence.
Very good. Kieran?
I do have an answer for that. I certainly have a vision. Right now, when it comes to uncrewed systems, it's human-machine teaming. Mm-hmm. That's the term. And it's all about our current technology status being one-to-one control and humans being in the loop for all of these robotic technologies. My vision for 20 years is that that term that is hot is uncrewed teaming. That at the forward edge will be robots and robots. Mm-hmm. In the middle areas, it will be robots and robots. The humans should be at the back where it is safest to be a human. And what I think we will see over the next 20 years is the enabling technologies that gets us to one-to-many control.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, take that C word out of it. It's not control, it's one-to-many direction.
Yeah, right.
And those humans will be on the loop, yes, monitoring, giving approval for decisions, and will be thinking not about employing the system, but how to employ, how am I going to most creatively employ these robots and robots to do the job. That's what I think the future looks like.
I'm so glad you went to some of those concepts of human in and on the loop, and how do we use human advantage best. I think that's really important. Pete, last word to you.
Oh, look, it's a bit hard to follow both of those. But look, I think start for me, you know, in 20 years' time, Australia needs to be, continue to be a strong sovereign nation, assured in our place in the world with strong partners around us. And the only way we're going to do that is in the previous 20 years, having invested in our own future to build the systems, the people, the processes, so that we have a strong force here in Australia. We have strong allies that are building asymmetric capabilities which can deter aggression in our region. And I think it's really important. The only way we're going to get there is by embracing autonomy. Artificial intelligence is a key component of that. We need to build our trust in artificial intelligence. We need to be able to trust that we can be on the loop. We need to trust that these systems are going to go out there and they're going to execute their missions in an ethical framework the same as humans out there would. That's going to take a lot of work. Yep. And the only way we're going to get there is by embracing these technologies now and iterate, iterate, iterate. We can't go from project to project to project. We need to have a strategic approach. We need to invest. We need to grow the capability to do it.
That's a great place to end. Thank you so much for a great conversation, all three of you. Thank you.
Thanks, Beck. Thank you, Beck.
Up next, Steph and George unpack ASPE's latest report, AUKUS Pillar 2 Critical Pathways. If you're interested in finding out more, we'll link to the report in today's episode notes.
Hi, I'm Steph Tiller. I'm the Strategic Communications Manager at ASPE, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Senior Defence Economist and ASPE Senior Fellow George Henneke. Welcome, George.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, you've just released a new report for ASPE alongside one of our other senior fellows, Roland Stevens. It's called AUKUS Pillar 2 Critical Pathways, a roadmap to enabling international collaboration. So this report looks at the technology sharing component of AUKUS, and it's a little bit different to other reports on Pillar 2 because you've actually talked to the regulators who will be implementing the trade regulations needed to make Pillar 2 work, as well as the businesses that will be operating under them and navigating them. So to kick off, can you tell us a little bit about the report and what it aims to address?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The report is a little different. It emphasizes sort of the latter of those two things you talked about, the businesses. The biggest thing to emphasize is this isn't the first time that this has happened. This isn't the first analysis that we've seen of how to increase cooperation under AUKUS Pillar 2. A lot of those previous efforts have not been successful. For those who remember back in 2009, again in 2015, there were big efforts to try to integrate the industrial bases of the three countries, the US, the UK, and Australia. And neither of those really worked very well. And so we wanted to go back and look and see what happened last time, the analysis that went into it, the regulatory changes, and why they didn't work. A lot of people have looked at the regulations themselves, kind of gotten into the weeds of them and tried to understand why they haven't, the changes haven't been able to spur the collaboration that we're looking for. What not a lot of people have done is actually go out there and talk to the businesses that we're working with them every day. So that was really our focus. We wanted to understand, as opposed to the limitations that a lawyer might explain to you, we wanted to know what practical limitations the businesses were facing. And that's really what we tried to explore in this most recent report.
And so the companies that you did speak to for the report, what were those main obstacles that they raised with you in terms of collaborating with other AUKUS partners to develop, you know, these next generation defense technologies?
Well, certainly the biggest one is the one that you hear about a lot, and that's the export controls, specifically the U.S.'s international traffic and arms regulations. It's difficult to work with. It always has been. Everybody knows it. And a lot of Australian businesses, their objective is to stay away from it. They try to limit collaboration with U.S. businesses because that'll give them that will, as they say, taint their technology with ITAR technology and make it very, very difficult to operate in the international environment with their products. So they try to stay away from that, and that's really the big one. I guess the surprising thing, I guess, that we found in that regard is. When these businesses take their concerns to the regulators respond and say, as I mentioned before, we've done this twice before. There are exemptions in place, and all you have to do is go use them. And the businesses say, well, that doesn't really help us because we don't have the money for lawyers. We don't have the time to go read through all those regulations. The penalties for violating them are very strict, and the regulations are very complex, and we don't have time to deal with it. So that was really the biggest finding there is what AUKUS needs to do if it's going to be successful is make things easier. It needs to open pathways for these businesses to take advantage of the exemptions within the limitations that they face in their everyday business. So that was the big one. But there were a lot of other limitations on cooperation that we found. Another big one was industrial security. Tendency to overclassify materials in both countries makes it very, very difficult for businesses to work together. There are also technology limitations, just pathways for businesses to share classified information, even if they do have those clearances, often don't exist or are very limited or expensive to implement. And then finally, the last one I mentioned is just knowledge. These businesses don't have good knowledge of the U.S. defense industry, and it's a very complicated industry. And if they're going to operate there, they need to have those networks, and those networks don't exist right now. And the liaison programs that are in place from the Australian government to help try to facilitate those relationships are limited and often understaffed.
So you just spoke about some of those challenges, but I guess when you were talking to these companies, were there any success stories or Australian businesses that were successfully navigating the international defense trade environment? And if there was, then what were they doing that was different?
There certainly were. We talked to a lot of those businesses. In fact, they were a particular area of interest because we wanted to understand how they made it work. And there were some common themes. Things like networks, the things I talked about before. These businesses had close collaborative relationships, both with Australian regulators and with businesses in the United States and customers in the United States. And they were able to leverage those relationships to work through a lot of the regulatory hurdles that make it very challenging for smaller businesses in particular who don't have those relationships. It was a bit more complicated than that, though, because there was a bit of a chicken and egg problem. Were these businesses successful because they were able to operate differently and have those networks, or were those networks a product of their success? It was hard to answer that question. Most of those businesses, the types that I'm talking about, were mid-sized businesses. So they were already on that path to growth. They were no longer limited by very small staffs and small budgets. They were starting to get more resources. They still had those Australian connections. They weren't so big that they were, kind of in the category of the global defense primes and facing that kind of competition. And so they were kind of stuck in the middle. And we were, when we talked to them, those relationships they had were fostered by the fact that everybody wants those Australian champions. And so when someone is successful or demonstrates that they can be successful, everybody jumps in and wants to help. If AUKUS is going to be successful, it's going to have to get beyond that. It's going to have to help all those businesses who don't necessarily have that visibility, don't necessarily have those relationships, and need to build them.
And I guess kind of on the same trail there, I mean, what do you think can be done to actually help grow and support the Australian defence industry base and, these smaller companies that are actually looking to get involved in Pillar 2? What needs to be done in that space to grow the industry?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that everybody's not starting from the same place. The U.S. defence industry is very large. It's very well developed. It's very well funded. The Australian industry is trying to join that much larger ecosystem. And these are businesses that don't have the type of experience that is going to be needed to operate in that much more competitive market. So all these problems that I'm talking about, they're going to take time. They're going to take resources for these businesses to work through it. You know, a lot of people assume that it's, for example, just a matter of an export license. You know, once they've got over that hurdle of getting that export license, then they're good. But that's not how it works. These companies are going to have to completely redesign their business systems, their shipping and receiving, their human resources. They're going to have to worry about vetting employees, all those things that go along with operating in defense markets. And getting all those business processes up to standard and compliant with the new regulations is going to be expensive, and it's going to take a lot of time. And Australian defense industry is composed primarily of very small businesses that their owners don't have time and they don't have resources to be spending it on things like that. And so in order to, you know, compete with those U.S. businesses, they're not only going to need access to the customers, but they're going to need the resources to get up to speed and to compete. And so the Australian government, if they expect to, really be on a level playing field and seek growth in their industry, as opposed to just, competition coming in from the United States, they're going to need to help, whether that's resources, whether that's training, as I said, some of the things I mentioned before, helping with those liaison programs to help these folks get plugged in with customers in the United States, creating tools to make compliance easier. Staffing up government departments so that they have responsive service and they can, these businesses aren't waiting, 6 months for these approvals they need for deals to go through, not just with the AUKUS partners, but beyond that, because a lot of these companies have global customer bases. Mm.
One of the other challenges the report touches on is around the need to align not only Australia's industrial security standards and data sharing protocols with the US system, but also Australia's technology and certification standards. Why is that alignment with the US system so important?
That was an interesting one, and it was one that surprised us that we don't hear about too often. When people think about Australia and the US and the UK, they think of Western technology, and they assume it all works together very well. But that's not necessarily the case. There are different technology standards across the different countries that help all those different technologies fit together. An example is radio spectrum. There have been cases in the past of, Australian radars, for example, conflicting with U.S. radios or vice versa, because the standards are different in terms of frequencies they operate on. So in the context of AUKUS 2 cooperation, all of those hurdles have to be smoothed out. We saw a really neat example of this. One of the companies we interviewed was won a contract, a U.S. contract, to provide a hypersonic test drone. And that drone was being launched by a rocket from New Zealand's Rocket Lab, another company that a lot of people have heard of. So these three partners, one from New Zealand, one from Australia, and then the U.S. Customer, were all getting together, and they're still working through the challenges of making this launch happen with technologies from all three countries. New Zealand, a long time ago, when they started their space launch program, they aligned all of their technology standards associated with space launch with those in the United States. And Rocket Lab, as we've seen, has been very, very successful. It's been a big enabler of their success. The Australian company is operating under Australian standards, or they have throughout their existence so far. And Australia hasn't done that. And so a lot of things that should be really, really easy, things like refueling their vehicle or, plugging two connectors together, they don't necessarily fit because those basics haven't been considered. And so it draws out the timelines and makes it a lot harder to collaborate on projects like this.
One of the other key issues that stood out to me when I read the report, and this has obviously been a big issue around AUKUS Pillar 1 as well, was around skills and the workforce that is going to be needed for the objectives of Pillar 2 to be successful. Are we doing enough to address the skills and workforce challenges? And if we aren't, then what needs to change?
Well, the short answer is no. And I don't think anyone would be surprised by that answer. We've heard a lot about it in the context of AUKUS Pillar 1 and, for example, things like nuclear engineers, things like that. What surprised us as we dug into the problem is how broad it is. It goes throughout the defense industry. And what we were specifically looking at was these regulations that allow businesses to collaborate. And so a lot of these small businesses have said, well, getting up to standard with these compliant business systems is going to take expertise that we don't have. And so they've gone to the government and said, we need your financial support. We need your training support. We need the people who have this knowledge to help us get up to that compliant standard with international trade regulations in defense. There's been a lot of debate around that. Should the government be doing that? Does the government have the funding to support businesses in efforts like that? What are the legal ramifications? Well, as we started talking to businesses, we realized that may not be the key question, because we talked to some of those businesses who do have enough funding and they were out trying to hire that expertise and they couldn't find it. Australian businesses have not been operating under the very complex rules of the United States, and they have, and that area of expertise in the economy is just much less developed. So even if the government were to come in with money and say, we're going to support everybody, they probably wouldn't be able to find that support existing in the economy. So it's going to be a long process. And that's probably the biggest key finding. Is it going to take resources, training? Yes, it's going to take all those things. But even more importantly, it's just going to take time to develop that capability. And the time is something that we don't have.
The report makes 12 recommendations to the Australian government to help ensure that businesses are equipped to succeed under Pillar 2. Can you run us through just some of those key recommendations from the report?
So I think we've hit on most of them already. Most of the big ones center on things like export control regulations and all the different things it's going to take to make that work. Some that I think are worth diving into a bit more. One is and I briefly touched on it, but it's the knowledge question. It's how do we get these companies up to par with U.S. competitors so that they can, not only collaborate, but compete and win contracts and bring, kind of grow that Australian defense industry so it's on par with the U.S. rather than the junior partner, because that's ultimately the goal. And that capability that Australians bring will help everyone if they can grow and become strong competitors. So how do they get plugged into that U.S. defense ecosystem? Australia has programs to assist with that. There are liaisons in the embassy. There are liaisons embedded in various organizations around the defense industry. And they try to help Australian businesses get plugged in, but those resources are often quite inadequate. And there are a lot of limitations around sharing of classified data, all these things that these businesses need to overcome. And they need the knowledge to do that. And then they need those connections to the customers and understanding of how the U.S. procurement system works. So building that out is something that the Australian government could really help with, by staffing those resources up. The Office of Defense Industry Support needs to be embedded across the United States. They need significant presences. Setting up things like sensitive compartmented information facilities in the United States that are operated by Australians and that can help businesses operating in the U.S. Gain access to U.S. classified systems and work with classified information and technologies would be a huge enabler. Another one is just subsidy programs. Something that's derailed a lot of past efforts has been protectionism, and each country's trying to carve out exceptions to this broad collaborative environment for things like small businesses and other particular interest groups in those countries. Those types of protectionist measures have been a big part of derailing the past efforts, because they make the regulations more complex. They keep that playing field from leveling out, so to speak. So, Australia has a lot of programs to support its small businesses. Those programs are tiny compared to the ones in the U.S. There's a lot of support, a lot of contract preferences, a lot of subsidies, a lot of direct investment programs that support U.S. small businesses. And if Australian small businesses don't have access to those programs, then they're going to be at a disadvantage from day one. So those are the types of things we're going to have to work through as we try to level the playing field.
Just to wrap up, what would you say the three key takeaways or reforms that Australia should focus on to ensure that Pillar 2 is a success and that also that we get the most out of it as well?
The three big ones are export control reform, and that's not only the Australian rules, but it's opening up the U.S. rules and the organizations that support them. It's about more than the regulations. It's about the organizations that implement them and the sort of their risk assessments. In the past, those organizations have been far too risk averse. And even when exemptions exist, it's hard for people to take advantage of them because people are too afraid of making a mistake. That level of trust is going to have to go up. And so that's number one. Number two, I would say, is the industrial security program. That is a huge obstacle that with a lot of difficult challenges to work through. And they're not just regulatory challenges, they're technology challenges. They're just investments. There's infrastructure that needs to be built to connect up these classified systems. And that isn't getting a lot of discussion in the press. And if it doesn't, then it's going to be a significant bottleneck to collaboration. And then the last one I would mention is those technology standards. That's a big one that hasn't been getting a lot of focus. And if, as any program manager will tell you, staying on schedule means staying on budget. And if we're going to keep things moving forward, hit these budgets and get these programs finished up on time, you have to start thinking ahead and smoothing out all of these hurdles along the way. Mm.
Well, George, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the ASPE pod today and to dive a little bit deeper into this report that you led. I've certainly learned a lot more about all of this, and I would highly recommend anyone that's listening to jump onto the ASPE website or to our socials to download it. It's well worth a read. George, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steph. I've enjoyed it.
That's all we have time for this week on Stop the World. If you have any feedback on the new podcast, we'd love to hear from you at podcast@aspe.org.au. And be sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.